unidentified flying object.
I'm Jack Osborne, and you're listening.
This is Hudson Hammond, and you're listening to.
I'm Richard C. Hoagland, and you're listening to.
I'm Art Bell, and you're listening to Dr. J Radio Live.
We have an unidentified flying object.
Welcome back to another great episode of Dr. J Radio Live. I'm your host, Dr. J, broadcasting from the City of Angels. As you know, we are internationally syndicated from Late Night in the Midlands, Black Swamp Digital Radio in the U.S., and also Deprogrammed Radio in the United Kingdom. And, of course, that also spreads through the EU. However, the terrestrial stations in the UK are specifically close to London and I believe Leeds. So if you're listening in the United Kingdom, you may be able to tune in from a terrestrial station out there. Now, as you've seen on the website and, of course, all through the promotion leading up to today, we bring you back another guest that you have all requested. And we haven't done this round, meaning from this August 7th when I came back, other than talking about the mainstream conspiracies of the deep state with people like Jerome Corsi, Roger Stone, David Adair, and whoever else we went into, the QAnon special with Michael Sala. But now we're going to get a different perspective because we're going to hear from, as I mentioned, as you saw from the website and all the promotion before, we have a person from the UK joining us today who happens to be a former BBC reporter, and this is probably one of the reasons you guys wanted him so much, is because he is one of the world-renowned experts on the Bilderbergers. He also can talk about so many other important issues that have to do with the ruling class of the world. So without further ado, let me introduce you finally live on this show, the investigative journalist and so many more other titles than that, Mr. Tony Gosling. Tony, welcome back, my friend.
Hi, Dr. J. Hi, listeners. Great to... thank you very much for inviting me back on. It's been a little while.
It has.
I'm back.
It has. Exactly. Now, this is a story that people here would definitely want to hear, is why did you leave the BBC to begin with to become an investigative journalist? Because that switch is going from mainstream media into the truthful side of things.
Well, now, the BBC was changing a lot when I didn't leave, I was sacked. The BBC was changing a lot when I was working there. My first year was in 1989, and I left in 94. So I saw some really interesting changes going on there, and the journalistic standards were being slowly jettisoned. I could see some of the best reporters, the best journalists, the best producers being sidelined, being some of them bullied, and slowly but surely a whole new kind of tranche of kids, I would call them, media studies students, people like that were turning up who really didn't know very much at all, whereas some of the best brains on the planet were slowly being shuffled sideways out of the corporation. The actual principle behind the BBC, I'm a big fan of, really, you know, something which is publicly funded, public service broadcasting, something which is seen to be a kind of benchmark against which other broadcasters will measure themselves. And I think it's fair to say in the 1980s, it was that. I mean, there were all sorts of brilliant documentaries produced, which did what journalists are supposed to do, which is to show both sides of the story, in other words, the two extreme views of whatever subject they're looking at, and everything in between. So that leaves the listeners in a position to make up their own mind of where their ideas are along that spectrum. But that was being jettisoned, and what we've got today is really a horrific travesty of what the BBC used to be when I first joined, which is simply a propaganda machine now, churning out really disingenuous documentaries which attempt to, for example, destroy the arguments of the real investigative journalists and bloggers, people who are doing, you know, really important investigations. People like Michael Tyler, no one's ever heard of Michael, but he's he works in the computer industry, and he lives on a canal boat in Northamptonshire in the Midlands. And he's done what I think is the best investigation into the deaths of bankers over the last 4 or 5 years. And he's compiled a list of nearly 70 bankers, mostly from JP Morgan, places like Deutsche Bank, one of the big Swiss banks, who've been found dead. You know, now I nearly said suicided there, but this is a very important story. We've got 70 senior bankers, either directors or senior executives on some of our biggest banks, mostly, almost all exclusively the private banks rather than the state central banks, who have been found dead in mysterious circumstances. And yet no mainstream press have really done any proper investigation into this. Only Michael, the blogger, who lives on a canal boat. So that's what we've got now is myopic media, mass media, whereas in the past we used to get, I mean, I can remember the days in the UK here where we had series like Panorama and The World in Action. This is in the 1970s and 1980s. Where when a big incident happened of some sort, controversial, within 2 weeks, you would have a hard-hitting documentary which really looked at all sides and aspects of it. Now, I'm not saying that they weren't biased. Of course, they were a little establishment biased. But you could rely on getting a good journalistic, professional journalistic view of whatever incident it happened to be, which was causing controversy and making the news. And you could rely on that to be at least to show, you know, a few different perspectives. Now all we get is the official government-approved news, which of course is exactly what good old George Orwell predicted back in the 1940s with his analysis of when he left the BBC. He was working for the BBC World Service when he left, saying, "Look, this is all propaganda, and propaganda doesn't work, so I'm leaving." And obviously the what he portrayed in 1984, is much of which is coming true, like these Samsung TVs that are spying on you, which was revealed by Julian Assange and these WikiLeaks. Well, Assange now has been shut down. The most radical, brilliant publisher in the world has been banned from the internet here in the land of the free, England. So I think the media now is a very interesting thing to look at, and I'll explain in a minute why and how I left. I left under very strange circumstances, really. I was looking into the cases of child sexual abuse in Salisbury, and that's where I was a reporter for a year, and on my final year at the BBC, Salisbury in Wiltshire, where all this Skripal stuff has been going on, and of course I've taken a great interest in that. And I was looking into the allegations by members of the public. In fact, I was working with another reporter on this, that two children's homes, which are care homes, they're called, were being used for sexual abuse of children in the town. And I was started to make a few inquiries about this. I was working with the local Salisbury Journal reporters a little bit as well and sharing some information with them. All of a sudden, I get a phone call from my program organizer to say, "Well, sorry, but we don't need you anymore, and we won't be paying you as of 2 weeks' time." So he basically gave me 2 weeks' notice. "We've run out of money," he said. So that was whilst I was doing that investigation. And then when I finished that in late 93, early 94, I just decided to put all the research that I had on the internet, and that's how, you know, the website started. The internet was just popping up at the time, and I got into land rights campaign, that is organising occupations of empty buildings, empty properties for the homeless, that kind of thing. But then started concentrating more and more on getting some of the research that I'd done for the BBC and that hadn't come to light out using the internet, the brand new internet. So that's why I left, and I didn't really leave, did I? I was booted out. But, I mean, the training that I got there was extremely good, and I also got to make a lot of friends amongst producers, even editors, and other journalists and researchers who also, like me, felt that the corporation was heading in the wrong direction and were determined to maintain the standards, the proper professional journalistic standards. And so, in a way, being outside the corporation, I've been able to do that with my radio show here in Bristol, is to at least do what I can to try and keep the, to hold the line, in a way, to try and make sure that at least there is some proper investigative journalism. And one of the things I always do is I try to make sure that we put, however much I might disagree with certain individuals, like our government ministers that we have here, and Prime Minister, And for example, people like Benjamin Netanyahu, we always try and make sure that those people's voices are heard too, so the listeners get to make their own mind up.
Now, a couple of things I wanted to talk about with what you just said. When you talked about the government-approved stories, there's a video on my YouTube channel right now. It's the top 10 staged media events around the world. One of the, I think number one actually, are former Fox News employees who said that near, I think it was during the campaign of John Kerry, that they started to get a lot of different stories from the top, the White House or any other place, that would say, okay, during this speech, cut over to John Kerry and then fade out to this, or this story is to be covered today, or don't talk about what happened in Iraq so-and-so this time. This goes back to the late 90s, early 2000s during Kerry's campaign. That's one thing. The other thing is it also has a testimony from the CIA going back to, I believe, 74, 75, that they're asked in a Senate hearing, does the CIA have influence over what is shown in the media? And of course, they're trying to not acknowledge the answer. And finally, they say they would rather answer in an executive closed door session. So that's pretty telling right there. When you mentioned things at BBC going wrong, and obviously the right stories not being portrayed, I can think of something major, serious propaganda that I got from watching a Martin Brashear documentary. When he did Living with Michael Jackson, people had different reactions, and including me. I looked at Michael Jackson, oh, geez, this guy's a pedophile, there's this. I mean, there's all sorts of wrong. What kind of sick man wants to stay in bed with his children? But I don't think that Martin Brashear even remembers that he not only was being filmed from Michael Jackson's own camera because he signed a release and he was in many of the shots, but that footage, that from Michael Jackson's point of view, the whole thing was sent to, of all people, Maury Povich, the talk show host, the one who does the crazy stuff during the day. He aired the entire thing. When you compare it to what the conclusions Martin Brashear says, it's two totally different things. And to me, Tony, that was the first time I had seen the BBC in such stark contrast of how they can manipulate the news by editing certain things out and leaving it to wonder your own conclusions, and literally cause the people who view it to have a completely opposite view. Is Martin Brashear one of those people who is constantly told by the government or the BBC, hey, do this way so you can have the story told in this perception as opposed to the truth?
I'm not privy to exactly what conversations Martin Brashear has, but he did do a very good interview with Princess Diana before she was assassinated. I would suggest, actually, these are kind of survival strategies that employees of these big media corporations use now. It's really called self-censorship. So they, in a way, they kind of tune in to the ideas and the thoughts of their managers and editors, and they know what is expected of them. And by delivering what is expected of them, that's how they keep their jobs. If they start to stray away from there, then they'll find some young person taking their place. So I think that's basically the way it works. I mean, also, Saving Serious Children, I don't know if you've come across this documentary the BBC made, but this was exposed 3 or 4 years ago, and it really shows the incredible extent to which the BBC is now prepared to manipulate footage. For example, it was to do with the Douma chemical weapons attack, alleged. And what they did is they were interviewing some medical doctor woman of some kind, and they actually overdubbed what she was saying because she was speaking with a face mask on, so you couldn't see that the audio that you were getting through the TV wasn't actually what she was saying at the time. And this was proved in a separate airing of the same interview with the woman on the actual news bulletins itself. So when that footage was used in a documentary a few days or maybe a week or so later, that footage had been edited for her to be actually saying something that she wasn't actually saying at the time, which is an incredible piece of it's sleight of hand. I've also seen, you know, the use of news footage on Channel 4 News the same sort of way, where they misrepresent, for example, what an audio track has just said, and they'll say it just afterwards, so you can't analyze it because you've only just heard it. Unless you were recording what they were saying and you can go back and test it, you won't realize that they were actually lying to you when they told you what you just heard. So these are the sorts of techniques which are, they've gone from error into deliberate manipulation quite clearly. And I think after the weapons of mass destruction fiasco with the war on Iraq, the attack on Iraq, what we've seen is an even worse. I mean, basically, people don't trust the media in the same way as they used to. Britain has got one of the lowest trust ratings of its London-based media anywhere in the whole of the Western world. And in fact, there are even other countries which you would think would be, I think it was one of them I was reading about, I think it was Macedonia or somewhere, much higher trust rating than the UK. So Britain is being manipulated to quite a great extent. And the good thing, I suppose, about all this is actually George Orwell was right. Propaganda doesn't work because people just don't trust what they're seeing anymore. And when they're told X, Y, and Z is happening, they think the opposite. They begin to think the opposite, like we were when we were young children, were told was going on in the Soviet Union. You know, whatever you're told, believe the opposite. And the other thing is, a really important aspect of this is the military don't trust them either. I mean, some of my contacts in the army I've spoken to over here have said that, well, after the weapons of mass destruction, of course, we're not going to be trusting not only the media, but we won't be trusting the intelligence services anymore, people like MI6. So this is, I think, you know, in a way, what they've done by using this ridiculous, appalling, criminal excuse to go into Iraq in the first place, with Colin Powell getting together with Tony Blair and the rest of them to fix this whole thing up, is that they've basically blown it. And it means that anything that they try to do in the future, there's going to be a great deal of scepticism about it. For example, as we've seen with the series of alleged chemical weapons attack in Syria, really, the military aren't buying it, and the public increasingly aren't buying it either.
You know, and that's actually a really good point, is that a lot of people are starting to realize there's a lot of BS, and obviously it's very apparent here in the U.S. It's, I think, more so lately, especially when you're able to compare the real mainstream media versus the non-mainstream media of what's actually happening and versus what they want you to have a spin, for instance.
Well, one of my colleagues over in... Well, he's a colleague. He's a friend as well, actually. I met him at a Bilderberg conference a few years ago. His name's Manfred Petrisch, and he was born in Argentina, got a job as a Swiss banker, a very nice job, for many years, and then he made some money. And he had a friend who was in the World Trade Center as well, so he was very, very skeptical about the whole 9/11 thing. He realized that his friend told him, he said, well, there were explosions in the basement before the plane hit. And he's now moved out to Abkhazia. He runs a fantastic blog in German, which is aimed at the German audience, called All Smoke and Mirrors. It's actually in German, Alles Schau und Rausch. And his approach to all of this, I think, is exceptionally good. He says that most of this mainstream press, the mass media, is, in his words, he says, this is for the stupid people. And actually what's happening is that there's a lot of education going on off-screen, you know, down the pub here in bars in the United States, where people are increasingly realizing that they've got to take what they're being spoon-fed through the mainstream press with a pinch of salt. And that, I think, is one of the good things to come out of all of this, is the, you know, as I was saying before, the less and less trusting of the press. Because this trust is, once you lose it, I'm afraid that the next big thing that happens, whether it be Pearl Harbor, 9/11, the London bombings on 7/7, whatever happens, and whatever we're being told, are we going to have to do something about this, react to this, you'll find that there just isn't the military and political will to go along with what the deep state wants to do. So I think they're in a bit of a fix, Dr. J.
You know, the World Trade Center, you mentioned that the bombings down at the basement. A security guard has come forward about that, who said long before anything happened up top that there was one, if not two, bombs went off literally in the basement where he was at. A couple people who were trapped there, and the demolitions that people talked about for instance, the New York Fire Department, FDNY, they talked about it being a pancake collapse. Here's another thing. I remember that day, and I mentioned this on the 9/11 anniversary when we had Rebecca Roth, who I think is by far the most brilliant investigator on 9/11 because she's a former airline flight attendant, and she looked at it from that perspective and then, of course, got involved a lot of people from the pilots unions and FAA. And one thing that has to do with the UK with another false flag, I had to look at the Salisbury attack, and I found a lot of problems with that. For instance, one, right after the Russia says they destroyed all their materials for that certain chemical after that one double agent was poisoned in the UK where all his hair fell off, Alex something I believe was his name, why would Putin destroy everything, have the United Nations come in and say, okay, everything's clear. So 90 days later, he's just going to use that same weapon and announce to the world we didn't destroy all of it, or after the UN came here, we made more of it. That's one problem. The second problem, well, the characteristics of that weapon or that chemical do not have all the Russian markings in it. One of them is the UK's marking. The fact that it doesn't have the same composition as what Russia used in the past, that it actually is closer to the UK alternative, is another thing. The biggest and most telling thing to me is if Putin was really going to do this, he would never leave anything to tie him back. And even bigger than that, he would not miss his target. What, you're telling me two or one out of five people are going to die and that person is just a completely innocent victim? FSB is not going to screw up that attack. What's your take on the Salisbury incident?
Well, first of all, let me just correct your pronunciation. It's Salisbury.
Salisbury.
Is the name of the city. It's a beautiful city, but it's surrounded by military. That's one of the first things I'd say all around there. You've got both Porton Down, which is the chemical and biological weapons centre for the British Army and Ministry of Defence, and which, by the way, shouldn't exist because the treaty said that these places should be dismantled, but Porton Down is still there. It's just about 5, 6, 7 minute drive from Salisbury. They've also got Boscombe Down, which is the Royal Air Force's main test flying base. It was where they developed the bouncing bomb, because I did a documentary about it when I was working in Salisbury, back in the Second World War to take out the dam busters, the Mona Nida dams. And also you've got, in Wilton, you've got headquarters of UK Land Forces, just a couple of miles west of Salisbury. You've also got the Chilmark Quarry, where there's, at least when I was there, there was still a secret nuclear weapons store there. And also right round Salisbury, which is the place called Salisbury Plain, is the British Army's main exercise area, testing area, where they have all their exercises. In fact, there are some of the roads you can drive past there. And a few months ago, I was driving along one of the roads across Salisbury Plain, which is one of the legal roads you're allowed to go on. We just stopped for a sandwich, sat by the side of the road, and you could hear and see the tanks firing at each other, for goodness sake. I imagine it's, I don't know if they're real rounds. I don't think that they want to actually be killing each other. They're kind of blank rounds or something. And that's what Salisbury is all about. It's military, military, military. So yes, you're absolutely right. This Novichok, if there was any Novichok even involved in this thing back in March with Skripal and Yulia, those two would definitely be dead. I was chatting to a chemical expert a couple of weeks ago who said, well, this Novichok stuff, if they release that in the centre of Salisbury, you would have hundreds of dead people, not just two people who went to hospital and then came out and they're okay. So there are major aspects of this story that don't make any sense whatsoever. What does make sense is the involvement of Jonathan Steele and the, was it Christopher Steele, and the Orbis Business Intelligence, which is basically a spin-off of MI6, a cutout for MI6, as they call it, so that if it, the whole thing is exposed, MI6 is not wrapped up in it and, you know, loads of MI6 officers are sacked. So they use cutouts like Orbis Business Intelligence so that they are the ones that are seen to be doing the bad things. And, of course, they were involved in this dodgy Trump dossier too. And he was the guy who was managing Sergei Skripal. There's also other evidence that came out in the Independent newspaper that friends of Skripal said he was considering making serious attempts to return to Russia. So the two guys that came over there could quite feasibly have been there to explore this as a possibility if he really wanted to go back to Russia, whether that was going to be possible or not. You know, there's also been, just today in the news, some revelations about, supposedly revelations anyway, about the Russian intelligence service, I think it's the GRU, sending two of their people to spy on the International Chemical Weapons Bureau. Now, this is really interesting because of the way they present it. They say, well, look, here's evidence that these guys were somehow involved in the Skripal incident. Well, it isn't any evidence of that at all, even though that's the way it's been presented on the TV and on the radio over here. All it is evidence of is that the Russian intelligence services wanted to find out what was going on over at the chemical weapons lab, which, you know, they're quite entitled to do. They didn't necessarily trust that whole process. And also, the Russians believed that the Novichok, and this is borne out by the facts, by the evidence that we've seen, that it wasn't actually Novichok that was used on Skripal and Yulia. They believed it was something called BZ, which is another type of nerve agent, but it's not a fatal nerve agent. It's a kind of crazy hallucinogenic drug which sends people into a kind of frenzy for a few hours, but it doesn't kill them. Now, this is the sort of thing that you can imagine that they would want to use on the battlefield because, first of all, because, you know, potentially you can then go and collect people as prisoners and interrogate them. And secondly, it's not too messy, so it doesn't necessarily, if it wind blows in the wrong direction, go and blow over your own troops. So, personally, I think that that's much more likely to be that sort of chemical that was used down in Salisbury. Another thing to say, which many people haven't picked up on, is that the chief constable of the civil police in Wiltshire, which is where Salisbury is, his name's Mike Veal. It was Mike Veal, and he was extremely robust. He was accusing the former resident of Salisbury, Ted Heath, who's also the former Prime Minister of Britain in the 1970s, a Conservative. He was saying that he has enough evidence, plenty of evidence, that he was a child abuser of some sort, probably not a paedophile. He was just interested in young men for many years. And he was saying this when there were all sorts of attempts to clear the name of Ted Heath. Now, anyway, Mike was a robust and a strong-minded chief constable who told it like it was. And those sort of people are like gold dust. Mike was moved out from Salisbury. He was transferred by the Home Office up to Cleveland, up in the distant north of England. And the new chief constable had just started the first day of his new job in as Wiltshire chief constable. This Skripal incident happened in March. So it was almost as if it was time to bounce the new chief constable, who wasn't confident, didn't know his superintendents, he didn't know his senior officers, he didn't really know his way around the county, into just literally complying with the wishes of Westminster and the Home Office, who send in what they call the anti-terrorist squad, who basically take over from all the local civil police. So they have a kind of squad of people come down from London who elbow the local police out of the way and take over the investigation. And this is, of course, what you expect in any kind of criminal enterprise, is that you have a bunch of police who are compromised, who then, you know, get rid of the ordinary local civil police who have got their loyalties to the local area, their contacts in the local area, far better place to do a proper investigation. And then you institute a cover-up. And any of the local police that start to complain just get simply, literally blocked from the investigation. Another really important thing is that what we've seen in the photographs, all you need to do is look at the photographs from March, April this year, is what you'll see is you'll see people doing searches in these hazmat suits, you know, these very sort of plastic suit that is put around somebody, of a particular object which is believed that may have Novichok on it. Stood right next to them is a fireman or a policeman with no protection whatsoever. And that proves to me that there is no serious belief that there is a threat of nerve agents in the area if the police or the fire brigade are stood there with no protection whatsoever. It shows to me that the whole thing is a kind of theatrical farce. And this is really, I think, just part of this ongoing Operation Beluga, which is the code name for the CIA, MI6, NATO intelligence attempt to discredit Putin in the similar ways that they in the past have discredited or attempted to discredit Saddam Hussein, Muammar Gaddafi, and President Bashar al-Assad, you know, using these same sort of psychological warfare techniques, which they're now applying to Putin. The big difference, of course, being that Putin is no pushover. He's not going to be a pushover at all. And the military are quite rightly getting a little bit concerned. What do you think you're doing? We are in no position to take on the Soviet army, which is now the Russian army, the Red Army, which is now the Russian army and the armed forces of Russia, because their technology could basically wipe us out and we're not going to take them on. So this is a real form of, I think, Operation Beluga and the attempt to discredit Putin in the press is a form of incredibly desperate brinkmanship. And it suggests to me that there could actually be some serious plans to kick off a Third World War at some point in the not too distant future. I mean, who knows when? But that, I think, is the only reason I can see why such an extreme attempt would be made. And I think there's a lot of people who are very annoyed about the way that, you know, at least in the deep state, that they haven't succeeded in taking Syria, that Putin has drawn them further and further into Syria with these ISIS proxies and other proxies, al-Nusra and people like that. And what they've done is they've now got really mad with Putin, and that is expressing itself through our mainstream press because the journalists just simply don't have the courage to ask the difficult questions of our politicians. And the politicians have just simply become the spokespeople for the deep state, you know, the Conservative Party, which is ruling Britain at the moment. We have a Prime Minister called Theresa May. You may have heard of her. Nobody elected her. She was put in power as Prime Minister just after the Brexit referendum because she was the only person left standing. All the others pulled out, so there was no election within the Conservative Party to put her in place. We've also got Gavin Williams as a Defence Secretary. He is the one who was very articulately said about Putin, "Oh, I want Vladimir Putin to shut up and go away." I mean, this is the level, I'm afraid, of infantile politics that we've got, because I don't think any of the serious politicians will go anywhere near the present government, who just seem to be almost playing at it, reading scripts, and even at the Conservative Party conference, which has just finished, annual Conservative Party conference this week, what we've seen is no debates, we've seen no votes, no proper discussions, just a series of speeches. And I was chatting to some of the politicians here in Bristol, the local politicians and the Conservative Party, and they say, well, there's no point in going to the Conservative Party conference anymore because there is no democracy there, and all we hear is a whole bunch of speeches, and they tell us what we're supposed to think, and then at the end of the conference we'll just ignore them. So that's, I'm afraid, the rather dire state of politics here in Britain. But there is a sort of alternative brewing up in the sidelines, which is getting very close to power, and that is the rejuvenated Labour Party with over 600,000 members here in Britain, which is unheard of for a political party to have so many members here in the UK under Jeremy Corbyn.
Now, one thing you've mentioned about the squads coming in from London. I've seen that photograph you're talking about with the people in the hazmat suit and yet That's other right. people sitting right next to them standing there with no protection on. That begs the question, how stupid do they think we are? It was pretty much known here that if Hillary Clinton was to win, because of all the stories coming out of Syria, that there was, in fact, no chemical attacks by Bashar Assad, because if he was to do something like that, I don't think he'd be that stupid, because Syria is not a first or second world country. It is, by definition, a third world country. If he was to use chemical weapons on his people, he would literally have to face the problems with the cabal, with the people who run the rest of the world, because the international community would have stepped in, wiped him out. And so if Hillary was to start a war there, or a proxy war, by saying, oh, they are having chemical weapons, let's go and attack Bashar Assad, then we are going to have Russia, and by, I think, default, because of their connection to China, a third world war, as you mentioned. Because of what happened in World War II with the Allies and the Axis being funded by the same banks in the U.S., Prescott Bush, if you recall, his bank was seized. That is George W.'s father, for everybody listening, or grandfather, George Herbert Walker Bush's father. And during World War II, I believe it was called the World Bank in Manhattan. J. Edgar Hoover had seized it for funding the Nazis, because it was known as the Nazi Bank to the feds. Yet, he still continued to do so and was given the bank and all its assets back. I'm going to use this time before we get into what you just came back, because somebody's asked a question a while ago, and I figured now is a good time to ask it. This is Jeff on Facebook. He wants to know, what is the role of the UK in Five Eyes?
Well, I think the UK is one of the key players, GCHQ here down in Cheltenham. I mean, the US and Britain are the two main. You know, one thing I say about Five Eyes that people don't often mention is that actually it's five countries, so that should be 10 eyes.
Yeah, that's right. That's actually a good point, yeah.
So I think, am I right, sir? I think it's Canada, New Zealand, and
Australia
are the other three. We are. I mean, this was built on something called the Yakuza Agreement, or UK-USA Agreement, which goes right back, I think, to the 1970s. And GCHQ is the sort of hub of all of this in Cheltenham here. That is being essentially privatised. I mean, which is unbelievable for something as important as, you know. And I was hearing recently that they had a new system, internal secure communication system installed, which was built by these Chinese mobile phone manufacturers, which I found absolutely extraordinary. Why on earth is the British Signals Intelligence Centre purchasing a system from China in order to do its secure communications? I would suggest that those secure communications will be no longer secure if they're using a Chinese system. But, I mean, I think Britain and the US, there's definitely a debate between who is really calling the shots. I think here in Britain, we all assume that the US is calling the shots, because we see ourselves now as the 51st state, really. I mean, we have always been a kind of Trojan horse for the United States policy into the European Union and the EEC, as it was before. And other European countries have always seen the Brits as a kind of, you know, cat's paw for America. But I do wonder sometimes whether the Brits have actually, you know, quite a good deal of influence in the US too, particularly for the better. Now, I don't know if this, I mean, you may think this is silly, but I mean, for example, when we had the Douma chemical weapons attack and then the very quick vote on military intervention in Syria a few years ago, I think it was when Ed Miliband was the leader of the opposition, so that would have been around about 2010, something like that, 2011. Anyway, whenever it was, the Brits, through Parliament and a very sensible opposition party, sent a very strong message to the US about non-intervention, and the Americans backed off. So I think the Brits can still have a restraining influence on the US. Now, I think we also have to look back, right back into history, into World War II, to look at this relationship between Britain and America. The nuclear bomb was designed and I'll try and get the exact month if I can. In 1939, late 1939, the first actual plans for nuclear weapons were, and we don't know quite what's going on in Nazi Germany still, but certainly in Britain, Frisch and Piles were these two Eastern European nuclear physicists that came up with the design at Nuffield University in Birmingham, late 1939. Churchill, who wasn't in government at the time, but the Ministry of Defence as well, the War Office as it was then, took a good look at this and said, well, look, this is a potentially a war-winning weapon. The only trouble is, we don't actually here in Britain have the resources to develop it. So there was something drawn up called the Quebec Agreement, whereby these ideas and this potential weapon was passed to the United States to develop it. And at that point, you know, the Brits, part of that agreement was that anything that they discovered would be shared with Britain. And, of course, at the end of the war, it wasn't. Even though nuclear weapons had been developed by the US to drop on Hiroshima, and in fact, it looks now as if actually not some Nazi enriched uranium was used in those bombs, had been traded at the end of the Second World War, and plutonium possibly. But so the Brits and the Americans had an interesting relationship at that point. And the British Empire was sort of disappeared at the end of the Second World War, and the Americans took over that role. But they also took a lot of this Nazi technology, including one of my colleagues has told me, who was in a position to know about it, that the Americans didn't actually have the technology to make the bomb explode, the detonate, you know, because that was quite complicated to actually make it go bang. They had all the right physics and all the right materials, but they couldn't make it go bang. The Nazis had two tests. That came out last year, by the way, that two tests in the Nazi Germany of nuclear bombs, that's on a fairly small scale, but one area which apparently is still contaminated with radiation in Germany. And this relationship between Britain and America, I think, is absolutely fascinating to try and get to the bottom of. My own conclusions have been that the bulk of the Nazi technology and Nazi ideas, and also some of the techniques, torture techniques, political control techniques, propaganda techniques, were more used in the United States than they were in Britain, and more embraced and taken up in the US than they were in Britain. I mean, we all know about Operation Paperclip, which is the system by which Nazi technology scientists, people, individuals, which, you know, some Nazis classed as capital, you know, intellectual property, people that knew stuff, went to the United States and were got off their war crimes trials as a result. There were many, many SS people, and the figures came out a few years ago, the number of hundreds of SS people that were given new identities by the US government. And I think that there was a bit of a resentment in Britain, within even the establishment here, that the technology, the nuclear technology at the end of the war hadn't been shared, and there was a bit of tension there. So I would suggest that the main driver for the war on terror is actually Israel and the United States rather than the UK, and that the UK may actually still be a potential restraining force on both on Israel and on the United States in order to stop you know, any kind of real escalation to a serious conflict. But let's just lay the cards on the table here. What's going on in the Middle East between Iran and Israel is getting hotter and hotter almost every month. We've had threats from Netanyahu to actually nuke Iran, which is absolutely unforgivable. It should be totally condemned by the entire world, but it has been almost ignored by the West, because the Israelis, for some reason, are our allies. And that sort of conflict would immediately involve Russia, obviously, who are committed to Syria, to the protection of Syria, invited in by the democratically elected government of Syria and Bashar al-Assad, and the failure of ISIS and the West proxies to take Damascus is almost like a Stalingrad moment. In the more recent, over the recent years, and the war on terror, you know, it's like that was it. I'm afraid the war on terror is now finished. And so that would bring in the Russians. Then you'd see almost immediately, of course, the United States come in on Israel's side, as it did, of course, in particularly in the October War in 1973 over there. And to a lesser extent, probably in 67 in the Six-Day War, because there was a few a few, you know, with the USS Liberty going down, there was a few, potential shots fired between the US and Israel on that occasion. But the 73 was a massive airlift in order to make sure that Israel could win the Yom Kippur War in 1973, the October War. So, yes, so the Americans would come in almost straight away, quite clearly. The US, the Pentagon particularly, totally committed to Israel through the lobby groups of AIPAC and things like that, putting pressure on senators and congressmen and congresswomen. And once the United States and Russia started to get engaged, then anything can happen. And most clearly, after that, you know, if this starts to become a protracted battle between the two big Cold War opponents, you know, America and Russia, the Chinese would come in on the side of the Russians, quite obviously. They've made it quite clear that East Jerusalem should be the capital of Palestine, that the Palestinian rights must be adhered to under international law as laid down in many of the UN resolutions. And so you have, you know, you can almost predict the way this is going to go. And that's the way it certainly seems to me. And I'm sure many military analysts are looking at it in the same sort of way, whether they're at the UN, the Pentagon, maybe, or I don't know if they would be keep their jobs at the Pentagon if they say things like that. Certainly the Ministry of Defence here in Britain and in other parts of the world are looking at that sort of scenario. And anyway, it seems almost as if Netanyahu is itching to kick this Third World War off with all these threats he's been making against Iran. So I think at the end of the day, I think, many wonderful people in the United States, but you've got a government there which is highly controlled. I would suggest there's a great deal of Freemasonry having an influence on who's in charge. You know, Bill Clinton was a Mason. I've seen pictures of him in his Masonic gear. And yeah, I'm not true. Saying we're free of Masons here. Of course we're not. You know, the King George VI from the Second World War, the king here was a Mason. Edward VIII, the Nazi king who abdicated just before the Second World War, was a Mason. But I think we just have to be aware that there is almost a clamp on the political and military power in the United States. In a similar way in China, actually, the triads and the secret societies over there do keep a very, very strong control on the political system, and they don't really allow much influence from ordinary general public to filter up to the decision-making process. So in a way, you've got a kind of sandwich here with the triads and the Chinese in the East, the Masons and the U.S. in the West, and the Russians are in the middle of the sandwich there somewhere.
I'm glad you brought up the Masons, because that is going to bring up, first of all, it's going to lock into what we're going to get into, which is the Bilderbergers. And the reason I mention this is there's a few questions that have already lined up. So let me address this for the listeners. Everybody who's asked a question about the Bilderbergers, after I bring up this next topic, since I think it was important to what me and Tony were talking about before the show, we're going to take a quick break. And when we get back, we're going to open that door to the Bilderbergers, and all your questions, people, are going to be answered. One thing first of all, you mentioned several great things. One thing that struck out is Project Paperclip, because I don't think we'd even have the nuclear bombs if it wasn't for that, or for even if that Project Paperclip with Robert Oppenheimer didn't involve the bombs in 45. At least they involved rocketry. The V2 rockets were brought over, the technology for that. NASA, the father of NASA, was Wernher von Braun, one of the biggest people. So actually, your reps, what I was thinking about is the Manhattan Project did not involve the people from Paperclip, but it did involve the people who worked on the H-bomb, and, like, for instance, Edward Teller. But the biggest contribution was all the rocketry and, of course, things that we still don't know. You mentioned they were freed and cleared of all their war crimes from the World War II atrocities, and they absolutely were. Not only that, they were given fat paychecks in the U.S., never had to do a day in jail, and were covered by the United States to be protected from, for instance, the people who were trying to bring back all the Nazis to still stand trial. What you said before the show, Tony, I think is relevant to bring about now, and then we'll take that quick break after that to go into the Bilderbergers. The bridge collapse in Italy. Can you talk to us about that real quick and why it's means
sure, yes.
something
the,
to
this
us.
Is, this happened about 6 weeks ago, maybe 2 months ago. It's the Morandi Bridge in Genoa collapsed. Now, you know, I always take a deep breath before I look at these sorts of conspiracies that I come across. Because I think you've got to have enough evidence to say, well, actually, I don't believe necessarily the official account. With the Morandi Bridge in Genoa in Italy, there's a bit of background to this, and that is that Genoa is an important city for the Five Star Movement. It's the home of Pepe Grillo, who's the leader of the Five Star Movement, which is a sort of left-wing anti-EU party which has been very successful in Italy. On the other side of the political coin is the right-wing party, La Liga. Now, the same week as this bridge collapsed, there were two bombs at La Liga's headquarters over in Turin, on the other side of the country. Sorry, no, Treviso, the other side of the country. And this bridge collapsing in the home of these two, and the bomb at the other one of the two ruling parties now in Italy, is potentially a threat. But what really got me interested in this is the video which shows two flashes just before the bridge, the pylon, which is carrying the bridge, collapses. Now, if a bridge collapsed in the way it did, I don't think, and I'm no great expert in structural engineering or anything like that, but to me, the roadway should just fall, and the pylon, which is extremely strong, steel-reinforced concrete pylon, should stay there. The road might fall, but that is not going to fall. It's incredibly rigid, unless, of course, there are explosives are used. And then I looked at some of the video that was released, because there was hardly any video released of that. There was apparently a blackout of all the video, and so nothing can be shown of the actual collapse itself, apart from this video shot by some guy who happened to be passing nearby. And you can see the flashes again in this video taken from underneath the bridge of one of the car parks, and you can see virtually nothing apart from a whole sort of load of smoke and these flashes. Now, that suggests to me that it could have been explosives could have been used, and that the only thing you have to look at, and as I've said, we'll be talking about the Battle of Arnhem later, is was there a motive for this? And the answer is absolutely yes, there was, because if you go to Forbes magazine, you can see that what the left and the right-wing anti-EU parties that are now ruling Italy are trying to do is to bring about the biggest threat so far to the euro currency, to the European Central Bank, Mario Draghi's little personal project, which is a parallel currency to the euro in Italy. Now, this is a major threat to the control of Europe and the EU countries by the European Central Bank. And that, I think, is potentially, anyway, a motive for sending a very clear message to Pepe Grillo, to the Five Star Movement, and to the La Liga over in Treviso. Listen, guys, you know, we are in charge, and we can get away with things like this, so don't mess with us. I mean, it's a typical sort of mafia tactic you'd expect from a organized crime run organization like the European Union, which I believe it is organized crime running it. At the moment, we've got the Commission actually in charge of the EU, which is all failed politicians. So people that we've voted out are actually the cabinet, the government of Europe. And Mario Draghi is accountable to absolutely no one. And he is printing money 19 to the dozen. That is to say, euros. He's printing 1 trillion euros, counterfeiting 1 trillion euros. It's only because he's who he is that he's not being put in jail for it. The European Central Bank are allowed to do it. If you or I to do it, we'd be in jail. 1 trillion euros a year is being printed, and QE is being injected into the economy to keep a dying and almost dead economy going.
One quick thing I also wanted to bring up before we jump into the break is what you talked to me before the show about the global debt. That figure is so outstanding. I don't think that if everybody was to liquidate everything they had, including those Chinese trillion-dollar companies, we probably still couldn't pay it off globally. What was that figure you mentioned?
Okay, so I just mentioned the figure of the money printing that's going on in the Eurozone.
Trillion,
remember, the Germans said they would never do this because it means that the economy is bust. if you've just got to keep printing loads and loads of money and injecting it into the economy to keep it going, that means the economy's dead. It's not working and it's not functioning anymore. So that figure is 1 trillion euros a year being made up out of nowhere by Mario Draghi. The figure for the UK, which is what Mark Carney, the governor of the Bank of England, is making up out of nowhere and injecting into the British economy, is 100 billion euros. But more staggering, really, is the figure given by Mervyn King, the former governor of the Bank of England. I call him King Mervyn because, you know, I suppose we think that the bankers are really running the show, you know, and that their minor minions are the sort of dukes and the gentry, you know, the aristocracy are given a few little crumbs from the table of the king at the central bank. You know, a feudal system, I think that's really what we're living in. We're not living in a proper democracy at all anymore. So that figure that Mervyn King gave for the debt overhang, the global debt overhang, is equivalent of £166 trillion. £166 trillion debt overhang. He believes that that cannot be paid, £166 trillion. And that is money which is sitting on the balance sheets of businesses and companies as assets, which cannot be realised, which if they had to realise those assets, they wouldn't be able to. Rather like, remember Lehman Brothers, Bear
yes.
Stearns? Remember
yes.
these guys? Do you remember Royal Bank yes. of Scotland that had to go begging on its knees to Gordon Brown for a bailout because they couldn't actually deliver the so-called assets on their balance sheets? You know, the people I think should be jailed for all this, really, I mean, and I really mean this, is the auditors, the people that go through these banks' accounts and then sign them off. The auditors are the real criminals here because they're the ones who should be put in jail for saying that these assets are worth something when they're not. I mean, and that we've got an even bigger problem now with debt, and this is what Mervyn King was saying. Back in February this year, you can find the article on the This Is Money website, which is part of the Daily Mail empire, and he's saying that there's going to be another crash, effectively, although, of course, the last crash wasn't a crash. This is a part of Newspeak. We're supposed to call it a crash. It wasn't. It was a crisis and a bailout. A crash is when all of the people lose their shareholding money, the stock market collapses, and also the currency markets collapse. They didn't, because they made more money up out of nowhere, and the public took on the debt that the banks had fiddled, and so we took on their mistakes. The banks should have simply been allowed to collapse, and we would be in, I think, a lot better, a more realistic situation now. At the moment, we're in this kind of cloud cuckoo land where we think everything's normal. Actually, we're living in this kind of feudal system with the bankers as the dukes and the kings.
One person asked a question about what we're talking about, and again, I think you might have actually answered part of it, but I'm going to read all of it to you. It says, how is there a global debt? Who is the debt owed to? People think numbers are real and they are man-made created. Value is based upon a person's concept, not anything realistic. That's word for word what that person said. I hope you got that question.
Yeah, I mean, I'll say it is, it's basically derivatives. So much of the assets on the balance sheets, particularly the financial institutions, and let's not forget, 80% of this QE money is going to financial institutions. It's not going into the real world at all. It's going to, 20% of it roughly is going to the big businesses, that's the big conglomerates, the cartels, that sort of thing, and 80% of it's going to the financial institutions. So effectively, these are like gambling chips. They're saying, well, we think that the market's going to do this tomorrow, this next year, this next week, and if it doesn't do what they want it to do, then quite possibly those gambling chips, which are there as assets on the company's balance sheet, are worth nothing. They can, I mean, sometimes they're worth, you know, a fraction or a proportion of what the auditors say they are and the accountants say they are, but quite often they can be worth absolutely nothing, particularly if the businesses that they're relating to and the commodity markets they're relating to collapse. You know, price of a commodity collapses, something, and it may be that they simply, you know, it's like an insurance policy where you try and cash in an insurance policy and the insurance company gets back to you and says, sorry, we've gone bust. That's what happens in a crash. And so there's all this confidence in these figures, but when it actually push comes to shove, it may well be that there's actually no real value there. And this is, I think, the problem, is that what we've done is we've allowed this system to, kind of casino system, to develop, where much of the money that is considered to be, you know, mean something on business balance sheets, bank balance sheets, financial institution balance sheets, is a kind of cross your fingers, we hope this is what it's worth. And it may be worth that at one moment, and it may not be worth it the next moment. So it's a kind of never land, a kind of fictional land, I think, that these people are living in. And of course, many of them are on whacking great salaries, and so they have a very strong financial motive, a personal motive, you know, looking after their kids, you know, paying the mortgage and all that sort of thing, to believe in this. It's a kind of belief system, really. We believe that this is real. I'm reminded of Bill Hicks, you know, and his jokes about this. This must be real. This has to be real. Because actually, I don't think it is. I mean, and I think it's becoming increasingly clear that much of this money is funny money, it's fictional money, and we could quite easily be in a pre-1929 situation now. It's just that if there was a crash now, we don't have an FDR, and we don't have the equivalent here in Britain, and there was a similar kind of public intervention, you know, by the government to start spending. We don't have those people in positions of power at the moment. So we're in a rather perilous situation where we could see a complete collapse of the currencies in the euro-dollar zone. If anything, you know, if you get something unexpected happening, like, say, for example, the Iranians decide we're not going to allow any transport of oil past the Straits of Hormuz, which they're quite in their rights to do. It's their territorial waters. If they decide to do that, that could cause a currency collapse, which would be probably far worse than what happened in 1929.
Catastrophic, that's absolutely sure. This person has a quick follow-up, and then we could take that break that I've been alluding to. So everybody about the Bilderberger questions, hang tight, and I will get to them all. It says, so basically this is an indoctrinated system where we are living to owe a life debt. It is still basically an ideology that means nothing at all in a reality or realistic world. I think that might have been more a comment, I guess, except the yes or no part at the beginning.
Yeah, I mean, it is. And I think we are starting to buy into, or we have been buying into for probably hundreds of years, further and further into this debt system. I mean, just take Russia for an example. I mean, they, for example, it's an extremely good place to live. And one of the reasons for that is that they've been through this total currency collapse in 1990, where they're basically the whole currency collapsed. They didn't have any money to pay for the soldiers, for example, which is a little bit concerning in a big superpower, as the Soviet Union and Russia was at the time. And then they slowly built it up from scratch, basically. So they've been through that experience. The other thing about Russia is, because of the type of economy it is, and the way that the social interaction takes place. I mean, for example, as the jobs collapsed in the city, a lot of people lost their jobs in the big cities like, you know, Moscow, Vladivostok, places like that, St. Petersburg. They have relatives and they have their own dachas out in the countryside. And so a lot of them moved out to the countryside and they were growing their own food. So they were able to be self-sufficient through that crisis. Now, that sort of thing just simply doesn't happen in the euro-dollar countries. You know, it may happen more in Europe, in places like Belgium. A lot of people have allotments where they're growing their own food, that sort of thing. Very few people do that in Britain and in America. We're all reliant on the supermarkets. We're reliant on money to eat, you know, whereas the Russians weren't. They were able to go and join their relatives and some of their own places out in the country, and they rode that thing out. The other thing is, people often point to the Russian economy as being something like half the size of the British economy. Well, the reason for that is because the Russians are not spending exorbitant amounts right across the country on their mortgages and on their rents. Here in Britain, we have a really exorbitant rents, you know, £1,000 a week some places. You're talking about buying a house is £1 million in London, almost minimum, you know. There's absolutely massive amounts of money is going into property, but you could build a house for something like a tenth of the amount of money you're being told you have to pay for it. So we've got a complete, what you call a property bubble. And that what that means is that in order to stand still, people need to get a fantastic amount of money every month in. And how on earth are they going to do that? You know, it's simply not sustainable to carry on into the future trying to find this money from a shrinking economy, which is in real terms is shrinking. There's just simply not enough money to go around. So the Russian actual standard of living has been going up for the last 10 years or so. So people have been getting a better standard of living, more money in their pockets, whereas in the West, ever since, really, I suppose it's ever since the Vietnam War in 75 and taking the dollar off of the gold standard, Nixon did, I think it was 75, that we've started to get less and less and less disposable income in America and Britain. And we've become used to this thing where every month there's less and less disposable income, you know, less and less quality of life, and the cost of living is going up and up. So that's actually what a good government should be delivering. The Russian government is delivering a better cost of living year on year in Russia. In the United States and Britain, we're delivering a worse, a more expensive cost of living year on year. And so I think we should be pointing at our governments and saying we could learn a lot from Putin and his economic measures over there.
This would probably be a good time to take our break. Stay tuned. Much more with Tony Gosling when we return. Hang tight, everybody. We'll be right back.
Know the truth. Spread the truth.
L&M Radio Network. Shining the light of truth. 24 hours a day.
Welcome back to more than the second half of Dr. J Radio Live. We have been speaking to former BBC reporter and current investigative journalist, radio host, and so much more, Tony Gosling, live in Bristol. As you know, we are internationally syndicated with Late Night in the Midlands and Black Swamp Digital Radio with their respective terrestrial stations in the U.S., with Deprogrammed Radio Network in the United Kingdom, along with their local terrestrial stations. Before we jump into questions, there is a shout-out from the first Patreon customer since the account was set up literally a week ago. About a week ago. This is A.A. Nakamura in Hawaii. I want to thank you, sir, for joining Patreon and following us there. And, of course, I want to give a shout-out to Ms. Pam Vredenberg for recently becoming a social media manager for this show. Now, we were talking about a lot of great things. I know we probably could have continued to stay on the topics that were leading up to the break because you guys are still being engaged on that, which guys and gals, should I say, are being engaged on those topics. But I would feel guilty if we didn't get to this topic because many of you have already written questions in from the last hour about the Bilderbergers. Let me just say two small things. Remember what I told you yesterday is that Uri Geller and Michael Dukakis cannot do a live show. I will be recording Uri Geller this Sunday and Dukakis shortly after that. He's just settling on his date. So because they can't be live, if you guys and gals have questions for them, please get them to me early. I did receive the first one with Dukakis. He wants to talk about the person who asked the question wants to talk about the DSA, the Democratic Socialists of America movement, and the new party founding in the U.S. So what better person to ask than the former presidential candidate of the Democratic Party in 1988. Okay, well, as you heard, I talked about our guest. If you caught the show late, then, well, you just heard his name again, former BBC reporter and current investigative journalist, Mr. Tony Gosling. So I am now going to bring him back. And Tony, this is a good time to swivel the topics and ask you about your recent trip to Amsterdam, because Amsterdam has the Bilderberger Hotel, which adopted the name for the Bilderberger Group because of the first meeting place. So were you at the Bilderberger meeting? Was it at the Bilderberger Hotel this year?
Well, okay. No. First of all, let me just put you straight on the location. It's not Amsterdam. It's near the town of Arnhem, which is the east of Amsterdam and Rotterdam, into basically near the German border, actually, on the east side of Holland. the Netherlands, and the Bilderberg meeting. It's wonderful that you made this little slip that you thought the Bilderberg meeting might have just taken place, because it isn't. It's the anniversary of the battle in the Second World War. That's in September, sort of 17, 18, 19, around that time of September, which took place in 1944 after D-Day, on as the British and the Americans were pushing towards Berlin. Not really as hard as they should have been, actually, because it seems to me that they were content to leave the Russians, who had something like three quarters of the German divisions on the Eastern Front, only one quarter on the Western Front. There was a lot harder fighting going on the Eastern Front in Europe at the end of the Second World War. So I've just come back from Arnhem, and a little part of Arnhem on the east side is Oosterbeek, and that's where the Bilderberg Hotel is. The Bilderberg meetings take place at the end of May, beginning of June every year, and they started back in 1954, just 10 years after this battle also took place in the same town, and Oosterbeek, that is. And I was really shocked to discover that the first Bilderberg meeting was took place at this battle zone where two former Bilderberg chairmen were fighting in that same battle in the Second World War. The first of them was Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, and I say fighting, although he was actually the prince and he was the chief of the Dutch at the time. He wasn't actually on the ground fighting, but he was involved in the intelligence side of the battle. He managed to get a resistance fighter in to through enemy lines, through no man's land, into German-occupied Holland in order to warn the Dutch that this massive operation was coming, Operation Market Garden, which is portrayed in the film A Bridge Too Far, which I'm sure some of your listeners will have seen. And the problem was that the guy that Bernhard secreted in to warn the Dutch resistance actually had no interest in warning the Dutch resistance. He went straight to the German Abwehr, the military intelligence, just to tell them that the operation was about to take place. Now, it's the biggest operation, and they portray this very well in the film, ever of airborne troops. It was three airborne divisions that were dropped in the town of Eindhoven, around Nijmegen, which is a little bit further away from the British and American lines, into Nazi-occupied Holland, and then finally into Arnhem, where we had the 101st Airborne Division went in round the area around Nijmegen, parachuted in, thousands of men, and thousands of the 82nd went into the area around Nijmegen, just south of Nijmegen, most of them. And then the British 1st Airborne went into the area around Oosterbeek and around Arnhem. And famously, the British managed to just about get to the bridge in Arnhem and hung on for days and days, for several, I think it was about 4 or 5 days, even though they were surrounded by some very crack SS Panzer troops of the Germans in Arnhem, and they were absolutely hammered. Now, remember, these guys, they've got fairly light arms, you know, they're paratroopers. They can't, it's difficult for the paratroopers, except they did have some gliders to bring in things like jeeps, anti-tank guns, that sort of thing, so they could try and deal with the tanks. But it really was a incredibly brave stand that the British 2nd Para, 2 Para, made at the Arnhem Bridge, and it's one of the great sort of heroic stories of the war. The only thing was that these two guys involved, one I mentioned was Bernhard, who was the chairman of the Bilderberg conferences from 1954 through to 1975, when he was discredited with the Lockheed scandal. He took $1 million bribe from Lockheed to get the Dutch to buy Starfighter jets, which were basically falling out of the sky, and he was discovered to do that and discredited as a result. The other person who was involved, he was a young man at the time, a young captain in the Guards, the Grenadier Guards, in a Sherman tank, driving towards Arnhem from Nijmegen, and that was Lord Peter Carrington, and he later became the Foreign Secretary under Margaret Thatcher in the 1980s, He went on to become, well, he was Defence Secretary under Ted Heath, Foreign Secretary under Margaret Thatcher. Then he went on to become Secretary General of NATO and Chairman of the Bilderbergers in the 1990s. He died earlier this year, actually. But these two guys, it seems to me, and through my research, first of all, Bernhard should not have been sending in somebody to warn the Germans about what was about to happen. As you know, anyone that knows anything about the military knows that a big airborne operation like this, paratroopers, it's most important that you catch the enemy by surprise. If they're able to prepare and get ready, first of all, they can get their flak units and ready to shoot down these Dakotas and gliders as they're coming across. The other thing that they could do, of course, is they can bring armour into the area, that is to say tanks, basically, which these poor lightly armed paratroopers just simply cannot cope with tanks. They have very little they can do to stop them. And so what happened was the Germans had got wind of this operation coming anyway. I don't know how they did that, but they were chatting. The ultra decrypts from Bletchley Park said they were chatting about this operation being about to happen. But they also got this spy, Christian Lindemans. King Kong came in to confirm that this was all about to happen. So they were very much prepared for this operation, even though so many things went wrong in Operation Market Garden, which began on the 17th of September 1944 and went on to the sort of 25th, 26th, 27th of that month. And this massive attempt to punch right the way into across the Rhine, that was basically it, because the Arnhem Bridge is the bridge over the Rhine. They were going to basically knock out go round the flank of the west of the German defences in the west on the Western Front. And that would have allowed the British and the Americans to then get into the Ruhr area, which is the main industrial heartland of Germany. It would have been a complete and utter panic amongst the German military, and it would have meant that loads of divisions had to be brought across from the Eastern Front, that the supply lines were cut to other divisions on the Western Front. So it was a very clever move, and it very nearly worked if it wasn't for the fact that the tanks, once they crossed the second bridge on the way to Arnhem, the last bridge before Arnhem, with Lord Carrington sitting in his tank, they basically just sat and waited there. And this is portrayed in the film by Robert Redford as the Americans. And I spoke to the paratrooper who was actually there, a guy called Captain Moffat Burris. He says that they took that bridge. I mean, these Americans in the 82nd Airborne Division very bravely paddled across in these little boats. He lost half his men in his company doing it. The Germans were just taking pot shots at them. He took the Nijmegen Bridge. And then, amazingly, the tanks started rolling across the bridge, and then they just stopped. They waited for 18 hours, 17 or 18 hours, until the British had been defeated at Arnhem Bridge before they even tried to get to Arnhem. And the American paratroopers were quite rightly incensed, angry, almost speechless, one of the accounts says, with anger. And they were saying, well, why don't the tanks go down there? And this has always been a bit of a mystery. But I don't think it is anymore, because the mystery seems to have been blown apart by the fact that we now know that the deals were already being done with the Nazis by that point. From the time of the Red House meeting in Strasbourg on the 20th of August 1944, just about a month before this battle, the Nazi industrialists had all come to an agreement that they were going to be now working with the Allies and doing deals at the end of the war. They had a billion dollars worth of securities, cash, money, etc., to bribe them with. And of course, they also had this enriched uranium as well. So there were deals were starting to be done, particularly with the Brits. And that's the reason I think that the tanks didn't actually really want to get to Arnhem, because they'd much rather see the Russians do all the fighting to Berlin. People I've spoken to, one of them is Major Tony Hibbert, who's the brigade major in the Sec 2 para at the bridge with Colonel Frost, famous, it's now called Colonel Frost Bridge, actually, this Arnhem Bridge. He told me that everybody knew that the war could be over by Christmas if they succeeded in taking that bridgehead over the Rhine. But the amazing thing about all of this is to see the return of Bernhard 10 years later to the Bilderberg Hotel on the outskirts of Oosterbeek, and the beginning of these Bilderberg conferences. I think personally, Dr. J, that this is a kind of in-joke. They knew that that battle had been sabotaged, had been fixed, had been thrown by people at the very top of the Allies. Of course, the soldiers themselves were incredibly brave, fought for their lives, for so-called king and country, but they were totally let down by their senior commanders, like, as I said, Prince Bernhard. And the other major person who let them all down was General Browning, who was in charge of all the airborne forces. I mean, he was just making incompetent move after incompetent move that make him look as if he was deliberately trying to sabotage things. And now we know that there was definitely a motive for that to be happening. And he was given a transfer to the other side of the world as soon as the battle had finished, because he was getting so much flack from other people involved in the army and from other soldiers saying that you were just completely incompetent. And they, one of the things they did is they blamed the Polish as well. The Polish paratroopers who were involved in the battle, who did their very best, were then scapegoated by Browning, and Sosabowski, who's the general, was sacked. Unbelievable, really, to see this kind of mealy-mouthed behaviour and the scapegoating of actually one of the bravest people in the battle by somebody who should have known much better. So that is, I think, the story, really, of the birth of the Bilderbergers, and the motive really being simply money. That at the end of the war, there were already overtures being made, particularly between the British and the Nazis, to do with the proceeds of World War II. And if you go and have a look at Op JB, this is this book by Christopher Crichton. What he does is he explains how the treasurer, the head of the Nazi party, Martin Bormann, who was really Hitler's treasurer, who had been squirreling away all this money in Switzerland and other places, he was actually rescued by the British right at the very end of World War II by a group of commandos led by Ian Fleming, you know, the Bond author, naval intelligence officer, Commander Fleming. And this is one of the reasons I think that many of these Bond movies have this element of magical truth to them. It's because at the end of the war, Fleming was disgusted by some of the things that had happened, and rather than drink himself stupid, he decided to actually, well, I'm going to get this out of my system, and I'm going to write some books about it all. So Fleming and Crichton, whose real name was John Ainsworth Davis, these guys were involved in this rescuing by canoe commandos, about 150 of them, rescuing Martin Bormann from the ruins of Berlin, from under the noses of the Russians, and bringing all that Nazi loot to Britain, and then starting to share it with the Americans, criminals, and launder the money through, mainly through the Dulles Brothers law firm, Sullivan and Cromwell in New York, into these 750 companies that he created. Bormann created these companies, and basically the SS people, some of them with new identities, just put on suits and entered the boardroom in a new kind of war, a Fourth Reich, a financial empire that was, rather than using tanks to take over, they've used for the last 70 years or so, they've been using banks, they've been using money to take things over in a much more subtle fashion. And I think that's one of the reasons we're in the fix that we are today, is that the Nazis weren't really defeated. They just, like leopards, they don't change their spots, but they did change their appearance. Actually, they did change their appearance from a, you know, sort of a jackbooted riots in the streets group to a bunch of financial criminals who have done their very best over the last 70 years to take over, turn the whole of the Western world really into a cartel, where the politicians are bought, the banks are really in charge, and their operators are these 750 corporations created by Martin Bormann. So that book, if anyone has, I don't think it was even published in the US, I think it was only published here in Britain. The author's Christopher Crichton, and the title is Op JB, O-P-J-B. And it just describes Martin Bormann being brought out from Berlin right at the very end of the war. And there's one other book which complements that. So that tells you the first half of the story. So what happened to Bormann after they brought him to England? Obviously, he was starting to distribute money, because he had the keys to all these bank accounts. But what another journalist, a guy called Paul Manning, has done is he was a CBS journalist in the Second World War. He was reporting on the war in Europe for listeners in the United States on the radio. And he wrote a book, Paul Manning did, after World War II, which was his swan song. And he did all the research, and mostly in the 1960s and 70s, and published it in the early 80s. It's called Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, where he explains and describes Bormann's activities in Argentina and Paraguay, because he didn't stay in England for too long. He went over to Argentina, which, of course, you know, it's like basically there were all sorts of dictators around who were happy to welcome Nazis, especially ones with lots of money at the time, where, as I said, he created these companies and basically formulated this Fourth Reich financial empire, which had initially been created, or the plans for it had been instituted and agreed to 1 month before the Operation Market Garden, the Battle of Arnhem. And then, of course, it was 10 years after that that the Bilderberg meetings first started. So Bilderberg, I think, is, you know, over the years I've been looking into these people, they are basically the secret government of the Eurodollar countries, and they're an attempt to turn the Britain and Europe into a kind of United States of Europe. Now, it does look as if Brexit might break that apart, but of course there are a lot of very powerful people in Europe that want to see a United States of Europe. There's a massive gravy train being created by the European Union, and so they won't necessarily be happy about that.
I'm going to read the last two questions in first, and then listeners out there who have sent the rest, I don't think we'll be able to get over all of them in the next 20 minutes before we're off air, which means about 15 minutes, since I do want to give Tony time to plug in his works. Now, these are a little bit loaded, so please bear with me because these are unscreened. Here is the most recent one. Why does history not speak of the depth of Allies' blockade on Germany to force Germany to accept the crazy Treaty of Versailles that would strip Germany of its total ability to live as a nation for multiple generations and allowed the spread of communism, socialism in the nation and literally all over the world? Basically, their doing was starving the nation into submission and killing those they had in prisoner at war camps. Weren't the real criminals the Rothschild family, who was swinging both sides of the war in the end, and not the Nazis?
Well, look, the Rothschild involvement, I'm not certain about. I think probably their main role was through being involved in the Balfour Declaration in the First World War. The Treaty of Versailles clearly was far too punitive, but, you know, it does seem as if it was deliberate. I think the plan at the time was to punish Germany so hard that, yes, some kind of dictatorial government was going to come in. But the reason I think they wanted to do that was as a buffer against Soviet Russia, which had appeared at the closing stages of the First World War. And they realized, oh, crikey, you know, this could be very dangerous, the spread of these ideas where ordinary people want to have the wealth and land and that sort of thing shared out equally amongst people around the country. You know, gosh, this is going to be a big threat to the ruling classes and the aristocracy in Europe. So I think that's the main reason why they did that, is because they wanted to create this kind of dictatorial buffer in Germany to the, you know, spread of Soviet communism. And that was, I mean, that was obviously, you know, easy with the benefit of hindsight to see how that backfired. But, you know, I think the Rothschild, for me, the Rothschilds, the main role there was, I think it was Lionel Rothschild, was the Balfour Declaration and creating the State of Israel, you know, the whole idea of creating this state. And this is one of the other reasons that I'm sort of quite, I sound like a patriot, really, but, I do love this country, and I think that we've got some really good things to be, you know, proud about in our history. For example, you know, the radical movements in the English Civil War, the Methodists, the Quakers, these kinds of organizations that came up in those days, and the nonconformist religion, you know. So as the country is trying to come up with this religion, you've got to go to church every week, you've got to think this, you've got to believe this. No, the people were simply just not having any of that. And so, yeah, that's one of the reasons I think that, you know, what we've got here is something to be proud of, and I am. You know, the British Empire, I think, was a dreadful thing, and it was sparked by the English Civil War. I mean, this is one of the things that people don't always remember or understand, is that the English Civil War was, you know, between 1642 and 1649, gave birth to capitalism, really. This was the first country in the world where the merchant classes were completely in control. After they got rid of the king, killed the king, Cromwell had brought in this merchant class, and that was why the Industrial Revolution happened here, because the merchants were running the show. They started the Bank of England at the end of that century, and I can see why people will say, well, the Brits started all this. But for the present day, there is still this understanding and memory within the military in Britain of having to face the terrorism of the beginnings of the Jewish state. You know, so the Irgun, the Stern Gang, people like this. The British military had to face the bombing of the King David Hotel. So whereas in America people do tend to get kind of hypnotized by the Christian Zionists, and, oh yes, you know, Netanyahu is doing this because God wants him and tells him to do so. I think here in Britain, the folk memory, if you want, of the fight against the Zionists at the beginning of, you know, the 1940s, is still fairly strong, and particularly because quite a lot of family members, etc., were posted over there in the army and the police over in Palestine. There's still some sort of understanding that maybe these people aren't God's chosen people or whatever. And this is another quite scary thing about the Zionists nowadays, particularly under Netanyahu, is that they have this, seem to have this idea that they're some sort of chosen race, some sort of chosen people, which sounds rather frighteningly echoing the ideas of Hitler. And apparently now you're not supposed to compare behavior of the Israelis to the Nazis. And this you can be called an anti-Semite, and you can be kicked out of political parties, potentially, and that sort of thing, and organizations, because of what you say. But what people forget is that even in the late 1940s, Albert Einstein himself was writing to the New York Times comparing the new Israeli state and some of the attitudes and the racist attitudes towards the Palestinians to the Nazis. So if Albert Einstein can do it, I'm sure I can.
Let me see what I can get more asked in the next 10 minutes. And for you folks out there who we probably will not have time to get your question, don't worry. This is not the first time Tony's been on, and I'm sure we can get him back on live so we can get everybody's question answered. And, of course, please don't hesitate to check out the other interviews that are posted on my YouTube channel with him, which will probably have some of these questions about the Bilderbergers you folks are asking will be answered in that interview, or those interviews, should I say. Okay, here's another one, Tony. What about the Rothschild family taking over the Bank of Britain and assisting in the split of Germany?
Well, I don't really know much about that, I'm afraid. I mean, you know, I think sometimes people do focus on the Rothschilds a bit too much. There's definitely very, very strong evidence of them being involved in the creation of the State of Israel. Now, you know, this is one of the most pernicious acts, I think, of the last century. This state was born in a racist fashion. And, you know, I make the point, and I do this when I go on the TV, when I'm given the chance to do this as a reporter, is that almost all of the Israeli cabinet are quite clearly not from the Middle East. You just look at the color of their skin. These people are white Europeans. So how can they possibly trace their ancestry back to the Middle East? They can't. They can trace their ancestry back to Netanyahu, for example, to Poland, and places like that. But, you know, these sorts of things should be obvious, but no one seems to want to speak about them. The other thing with the Rothschilds is quite clearly they are involved very strongly here with the Bilderbergs, because Evelyn de Rothschild was there, and others. I think it's Jacob Rothschild's got some sort of involvement. He's probably the most powerful Rothschild at the moment. And there is this myth about the Battle of Waterloo, which the Rothschilds tried to, even took a court case to try and say this never happened. Well, of course, it did happen, and they used the war to make a lot of money. And so you have to remember, every time there's a war, whether it's the First World War, Second World War, Third World War, Yemen, or Syria, there's always people making more money out of war. This is the frightening thing. You know, you chat to people and say, well, nobody wants a war. Actually, no. Some people do want a war. So long as they're not likely to die themselves in it or lose any of their loved ones, they make a lot of money out of war. And I think we've really got to have a media that starts to interrogate this very important, knotty question, and a military that starts to take it seriously as well. So, you know, I think ultimately the bankers are the modern kings. The Rothschilds are certainly big players in that. And they had this interesting relationship, didn't they, between the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds, which was the Rockefellers being the US version.
Okay,
the Rothschilds being the British and the European ones. But I mean, I met David Rockefeller when I was covering the Bilderberg Conference in, I think it was in 2003, roughly, at Versailles, when they were holding the conference, was at, just near the Palace of Versailles. And he was having a wander in the garden. I went over to him and had a chat. And you know, David Rockefeller, I was thinking, gosh, this, you know, this guy's very powerful, blah, blah, blah. But he came across as a very, very affable chap and a nice guy. Now, he didn't want to talk about the things I wanted to do. He was very deftly steered the conversation away to talk about the, you know, the lovely fish restaurant that was in the town, or, you know, whatever, something irrelevant, small talk, that sort of thing. But I'm aware now, having chatted to, at the Dresden conference, some of the Bilderbergers, that some of them now have a very, very more, much more arrogant attitude. And that one I spoke to was James A. Johnson, who was the bagman for Hillary Clinton and for Barack Obama at Goldman Sachs. he was really aggressive, rude. And the other one I spoke to was Jacob Wallenberg, and he's the main banker of Sweden. And their family was playing both sides during World War II. He had his brother, or his, I think it was his father and his uncle. Each one was backing the Allies or the Germans. And a lot of these Bilderbergers, if you look into their history, they were doing this kind of thing. Shell was doing it. Unilever was doing it. They were there on the very early days of Bilderberg, Unilever were. And they would have branches in on both sides of the war. So they knew that whichever side lost, they'd shut that branch and the winning side would carry on. So that's the sort of thing I think you're dealing with the Bilderbergs, is an organization which is planning wars, planning, you know, involved in making them happen. I mean, one of the leaks at the 2003 Bilderberg was that they were going to invade Iraq, and no one really believed it, but they did. I think it was the 2002, it was the year before. You know, so these people are definitely involved. They're involved in the Kosovo War, they've been involved in Syria. You know, all these people like Richard Pearl involved in this. But at the end of the day, these people really are, I think, they're driving the entire sort of media agenda and political agenda right across the Western world. They've got that much power. And those politicians that want to be successful know that it's the bankers and the Bilderberg types that they've got to suck up to if they want to make it in politics, because the money, it's money that buys success in elections and political parties, are bought nowadays. There's very, very little independent free thinking. And the only thing that could really stop this whole process going on to a kind of corporate dystopia is if it was being interrogated by the mass media, which unfortunately it's not. The mass media is part of the problem. These are just big companies. They also have their money squirreled away in tax havens, and they have really lost any kind of real sense of public duty. They are bought and paid for. I mean, one could argue bought and paid for by this Fourth Reich, Martin Bormann network of financial influence that's grown up since the Second World War.
Okay, here is another one. And again, people, we're going to do our best to get the next 5 or so minutes to hopefully accommodate all of you. Okay, William from, is it Zetland, asks, are the Rothschilds still the owners of the Bank of Britain, or did they influence or make the request of George Soros to crash the Bank of England so that they can capture ownership of that too?
Answer is, we just don't know. We don't know who owns the shares in the Bank of England. Because it was set up under a royal charter, there's no transparency. I remember actually going to the museum at the Bank of England and saying, well, who owns the shares in this bank? And the guy just shrugged his shoulders and said, well, we don't know. I would imagine the Queen is involved. But, you know, if there is no financial transparency, you know, this should ring alarm bells for any journalist. But we see very, very little questioning of that. Mark Carney is the governor of the Bank of England at the moment. I think he's probably one of the most Dracula-like governors we've ever had. You know, this guy, he's almost like blood dripping from his teeth, you know. He is the guy who was responsible for the financial crisis in the first place. He was chairing the Committee for Regulating Global Banking at the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland, which funded Hitler, and which the Bretton Woods Conference voted that bank should be closed down because it had been financing Hitler. So it moved into an anonymous chocolate shop anonymous office above a chocolate shop in Basel, Switzerland. It's now got a headquarters which is called the Tower of Basel in Switzerland. So it survived. And this, I think, is particularly concerning when you've got the pound being safeguarded, supposedly, by Mark Carney, who's the man who created the financial crisis in the first place. Extremely worrying.
Okay, let me try to pick one more here that I would think would try to be on point. See, the problem is I'm reading them on screen. Okay, well, I'll just go with this one. Do you believe that the Bilderberger Group wanted to censor the late Princess Diana's voice because she was open and transparent when it comes to the lifestyle of those in Buckingham?
Well, look, I don't think the Bilderbergers took any direct role in censoring Diana. In fact, she was all over the papers, in fact, before she died. The thing is, the way this works is it's a sort of groupthink. Go back to your George Orwell. There are people, I mean, having met these Bilderbergers at the Bilderberg Conference, I would stress to everybody, come to the Bilderberg Conferences, come and meet the Bilderbergers. Find out, you know, give them a bit of sort of profiling for yourself. Find out, oh, this is a Bilderberger. And you can actually speak to them. Usually you get a chance to have a chat with them. And with Diana, it was quite clear she was murdered. She was assassinated because of her support for the anti-landmines campaign, but also because she was proving to be a bigger media star than Prince Charles. Now, obviously, the future King of England, if he ever makes it there, was annoyed. And I'll tell you a little anecdote, actually, because I did, when I was working for the BBC, cover something called the Symphony for the Spire in Salisbury, which was a beautiful concert that was with Pavarotti, Placido Domingo, fantastic live concert. And they both arrived by helicopter, but actually only Prince Charles came out of the helicopter. And all the crowd were saying, well, where's Diana? Where's Diana? This is in the early 1990s. And Charles was sort of shaking hands with people, but everyone was saying to each other, I was, you know, covering the reaction of the crowd, where's Diana? And suddenly, about 10 minutes after Charles had come, she stepped out into the doorway of the helicopter, and the whole crowd erupted. I'd never seen anything like it. And nobody was looking at Charles. Nobody was interested in Charles. And if looks could kill, I was looking at Charles. He couldn't bear the fact that the crowds loved her so much and weren't interested in him. Quite clearly, if anyone wants to really look into and read the definitive book on this, it's called, I think it's The Assassination of Princess Diana or The Death of Princess Diana, The Paris-London Connection by John Morgan. Who's dead now, unfortunately, but he wrote a terrific a forensic analysis of the police reports and the coroner's reports, which proves conclusively, really, that it was a royal series of meetings that decided, called the Way Ahead Group, that decided that Diana had to go because she was proving a massive embarrassment to the royal family. As well as this landmines business, which then brought the arms companies on board. And one of the Bilderbergers, actually, a guy called Sherard Cowper-Coles, is one of the people possibly fingered to be masterminding that operation, as he was brought over apparently to work for MI6 in Paris just for the 2 weeks running up to when Diana died. So I don't think the Bilderbergers had an absolutely direct hand in it, but they have this, I suppose it's a sort of groupthink mentality where we are in control. Anybody that's famous or powerful who's outside our control is going to go. I mean, they simply will not stand for them. Rather, like I said before about Bill Hicks saying, you know, this has to be real. And anybody that starts to puncture the bubble, they may not be around too long for one reason or another. I mean, we've got major questions over two senior British politicians, Robin Cook, who was the Foreign Secretary, the way he died, and also the leader of the opposition, John Smith, in the early 1990s. He also died in mysterious circumstances. And both of them were very articulate critics and, you know, all over the press criticising the US policy in Iraq and all sorts of, you know, war policies, that sort of thing, and even economic policies. And so I don't think it's beyond the Bilderbergers' possibility to, or, you know, or actually order people to be eliminated. I mean, all you have to do, if you want to get an idea of how the Bilderbergers operate, look at the P2 scandal in Italy in the 1980s. You know, what you got there was a secret government, a parallel government running the country, meeting once a week, Licio Gelli, the fascist chairing it, and the chiefs of the police, the chiefs of the press, the newspaper editors, the bankers, people from the big oil companies, all the big corporations were basically just running the country from behind the scenes. And they even had the former, I think he was nearly the prime minister or former prime minister, assassinated because he wanted to bring the communists into the government. And so they set up a whole pretense of the Red Brigades kidnapping him, and they killed him. So, you know, these are the sorts of extents that they'll go to, I think, in order to kind of keep control. They're basically control freaks, Dr. J.
I'm glad you brought up what people were looking up with Diana, because she is rightfully known as the People's Princess. Unfortunately, we have about a minute left, so all you listeners whose questions we didn't get to, we will next time. Briefly, Tony, I was hoping you could plug in all your links, your shows, and if you could briefly tell people what you're going to be working on now and what's next for you.
Well, I've been working on this this presentation, which you can actually just about find online. If you go, I'm trying to think whereabouts, I'll be putting it up on my Twitter feed very, very soon, like probably just within the next 10 minutes or so, which is this presentation I did over in Oosterbeek called The Traitors of Arnhem, which really looks at the sabotage of this World War II battle, features in A Bridge Too Far, the film by Joseph E. Levine, and through the book of Cornelius Ryan of the same name about that battle. And so that will be going up online very soon. My radio show website, where you can listen live on a Friday here in the UK, it goes out between 1800 and 2000. That's 6 p.m. and 8 p.m. every Friday, where we go in depth in a bit of local politics to start with. And, you know, you can find out how the city is getting on that sent John Cabot over to Newfoundland and so-called discovered America, even though actually quite a few tens of millions of Native Americans had already discovered it beforehand. So that's at thisweek.org.uk, and you'll find show links there so you can download and have a listen to the podcast, or you can just click on a few links and see that some of the stories we've been covering. Also do something called the Bilderberg.org website, which has got some more details as well of the talk I've just done over in Oosterbeek about the real origins of the Bilderberg conferences and this attempt to bring a United States of Europe about, which is what they have been up to from the 1950s up until today. And I also have another website, which is the 9/11 Forum. That's 911, the numbers, 911forum.org.uk, which was really started by the UK 9/11 Truth Movement, and you'll find all sorts of up-to-date info on historical stuff, conspiracies, all sorts of things like the Concorde crash, you know, loads of things on there, massive amount of info, including things like the London bombings, all of, obviously things to do with the implications of the 9/11 attacks and some of the most recent terrorist attacks, like the one recently in Iran, which amazingly, by the NATO countries, was classed as a not a terrorist attack. Because, of course, it's double standards all the way when it comes to Iran. You know, the Israelis can get away with threatening nuclear war, but if the Iranians get a terrorist attack, it's not. It's some sort of must-be freedom fighters. And, of course, the fact of the matter is people like John McCain have been egging these people on for years to have, you know, basically funding terrorists within Iran, which is appalling. And I would also urge your listeners, if they can save up a few bob, to go and visit Iran. It's an absolutely beautiful country before it gets annihilated by Netanyahu's nuclear weapons.
Yes, everybody out there, I do hope that they are able to see it, because I have a good friend, Sean Stone, who is constantly there and always wonders why we're always in such a state of war. And because we do back Israel, the U.S., and the U.K., then it seems that every time they have a problem, we are interjected. Again, I want to thank everybody, and I want to apologize to all the listeners whose questions we didn't get to this time, but I'm sure many of them will be answered from the previous interviews, and of course, when Tony comes back. Because we are out of time, I will make things very quick for you folks. Again, the first Patreon I want to thank is A.A. Nakamura from Hawaii. Remember, folks, the only thing you need to remember about this show is the name of it, Dr. J Radio Live. That is DRJ Radio Live. For instance, the domain drjradiolive.com, every single social media outlet or account and everything is DRJ Radio Live. From minds.com, and by the way, go on there. You could check in my Twitter feed. There is a referral link which will give you some free tokens, cryptocurrency you earn for doing everything you do in social media. Facebook, Twitter, Flickr, Tumblr, Instagram, Google+, Buffer, whatever you could think of, YouTube, it's all under the same thing. That is Dr. J Radio Live. With that being said, folks, we are sorry for going over the time, and hopefully we're not cutting too much into the next show. I know you're still on break, but we want to thank you all, and we will catch you all soon. Make sure you check to the website, check on it for current guests. And with that being said, I am officially signing off, folks. Good night.